From Washington, this is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, a U.S. lawmaker says only a wider U.S. role will defeat the IS group. Strategies for blunting terrorist social media campaigns.
The best way to counter it is through teaching young people about their faith, critical thinking.
An analyst says Middle East peace is as important now as ever. And what humans are doing to threaten the oceans, it's all ahead. I'm Susan Yawkey. U.S. Senator Lindsey Graham says the only way to end the gruesome beheadings by the Islamic State group is by degrading and destroying the insurgency, which has captured large swaths of Iraqi and Syrian territory. VOA's Victor Beatty reports the latest beheading of a Japanese journalist by the IS group has renewed a national debate on Japan's ability to defend itself.
U.S. Senator Lindsey Graham, a member of the Senate's Armed Services Committee, told a U.S. television audience Sunday President Obama has the right goal but the wrong strategy to defeat the Islamic State group ISIL.
An aerial campaign will not destroy ISIL. You're going to need boots on the ground, not only in Iraq, but Syria. And there's got to be some regional force formed with an American component, somewhere around 10,000, I think, American soldiers, to align with the Arab armies in the region and go into Syria and take back territory from ISIL.
Graham says Syria and Iraq are the best platforms from which to launch new terrorist attacks on Western targets that he has seen since the September 11, 2001 attacks on the United States. The beheading by the IS group of 47-year-old Japanese journalist Kenji Goto, announced in a video released Saturday, brought international condemnation. The UN Security Council Sunday called the execution heinous and cowardly, saying those responsible shall be held accountable. President Barack Obama denounced what he called a barbaric act and vowed to continue taking decisive action to degrade and ultimately destroy the IS group. Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe Sunday said he was infuriated by Goto's beheading and that of fellow Japanese Haruna Yukawa a week earlier. Monday, Mr. Abe vowed not to give in to terrorists and to increase Japan's humanitarian aid to the Middle East. The Prime Minister urged Japanese lawmakers to ensure the safety of Japanese citizens wherever they are. He also said the government should not limit where the country's defense forces can be dispatched to defend allies in collective self-defense. Tokyo-based analyst Michael Kuchek of the MIT Center for International Studies says Mr. Abe's government wants to debate easing restrictions on military rescue missions in the event Japanese are again put at risk.
They have an idea that they need forces that can hold a position, whether it's an airport or a seaport, allowing Japanese self-defense forces to extract Japanese civilians from danger zones.
However, he says polling suggests the Japanese public does not want any dramatic revisions to its pacifist post-war constitution. He says the public also views Goto as a heroic journalist.
He reported on children of war zones, on refugees. He really went into some very, very dangerous places and coming out again every time, but a man of tremendous bravery who was trying to report on what was going on in the world from ground level. And for many Japanese, they did not know him before, but everyone knows him now. And everyone is deeply depressed by his death.
Also appearing Sunday on U.S. television, Jordan's foreign minister, Nasser Judeh, says his government does not know the fate of a Jordanian fighter pilot threatened with death by his Islamic State captors. He says Amman has renewed its pledge to release a female Iraqi insurgent on death row in Jordan.
We have said publicly that if we do get proof of life and if our pilot is released, we are willing to release this woman. But like I said, so far, we have seen no proof of life, which we have been asking for.
The pilot was captured in December after his fighter plane was downed over an Islamic State-controlled area of Syria. Victor Beatty, VOA News, Washington.
The group known as the Islamic State has been active on several fronts in recent days, even as IS militants were retreating from Kobani in northern Syria. An offshoot of the group claimed responsibility for an attack in Libya's capital, Tripoli. At the same time, an IS spokesman announced that what he called the caliphate was expanding into South Asia. In a message posted on the internet, the spokesman wrote, "We bring the Mujahideen good news of the Islamic State's expansion to Khorasan," a reference to the historical region that now encompasses Afghanistan and Pakistan. Western media experts are expressing concern about how militant groups are using social media to disseminate publicity aimed at blurring the line between mainstream Islam and their ideology of violence. VOA's Mohammed El-Shenawi spoke with Dalia Mogenden, director of research at the Institute for Social Policy and Understanding in Washington, about strategies for blunting the social media campaign to lure young Muslims to terrorist groups.
What are the real roots of radicalism that cause some young Muslims to join radical or terrorist organizations?
It's very hard to tell. There's many variables, but I think the best research shows that the number one thing is alienation. It's the sense that you don't belong and that you're angry at the wider society. But at the end of the day, I think we really have to see these issues as criminal acts and deal with them in such a way. Separate from that, I think it's important for European societies and societies generally to make sure that all of their citizens are included in their decision-making process in the country.
How about the effect of recruiting through the Internet? How would you counter that?
It's very hard to counter the recruitment through the Internet, which has been shown as one of the number one ways that young people are pulled into these organizations. I think the best way to counter it is through teaching young people about their faith, critical thinking, and giving them legitimate ways to address the grievances that they're angry about.
What should be Muslims' response to counter this new wave of radicalism?
Well, I think that, you know, it's important to understand that ordinary Muslims don't have a lot of power. I'm going to reject very vehemently the idea that we could do more and are not doing it, because if anything, we are the number one victims as Muslims of these terrorist organizations. They are, first of all, preying on our children, and they are killing our people before they're killing anyone else, too. So to suggest that we're apathetic or we're looking on and don't care is to ignore the facts. But just like any criminal organization, they're secretive. They are operating outside of the normal institutions that we all go to. And I am not really sure what we can do about this issue other than protect our own children from this kind of recruitment and continue to preach and explain to our people and to our societies, as we already have been, the mainstream and legitimate teachings of Islam.
Final question, Dalia. Is there any role that the U.S. and the West can play in dealing with the roots of radicalism other than launching a war on terrorism?
I think the best way that they can help stem this problem, aside from a military response, which sometimes can be the worst one, is to really have an honest conversation about the grievances. I mean, the issue with ISIS specifically, would ISIS exist if we hadn't allowed Bashar al-Assad free rein to slaughter his people for 3 years? I think that we have to ask much harder questions than just about how someone's interpreting a verse from the Quran.
Dalia Mogadel, researcher at the Institute for Social Policy and Understanding in Washington. The need to resolve the long-standing Israeli-Palestinian conflict by reaching a two-state solution is as urgent as ever, according to Matthew Duss. He is president of the Foundation for Middle East Peace, a nonprofit organization created in the wake of the Camp David peace accords to foster peace and justice between Israelis and Palestinians. He discussed the issue on VOA's Press Conference USA with Carol Castiel.
A lot of Americans have this idea in their mind of Palestinians that it's all violence. That's somewhat understandable given the experience of the Second Intifada when you had buses and restaurants and cafes blowing up. But I think it's very important for people to understand that you also have a very, very strong constituency that understands that nonviolent resistance and civil disobedience are the ways that Palestinians are going to achieve their national aspirations and their own human rights.
What about attempts now, in light of the collapsed U.S.-led talks, in light of this very unfortunate Gaza war that we witnessed last year, and now you have the Palestinians tried to join the International Criminal Court? How helpful or hurtful do you think this is? Of course, the United States is on record saying this is not helpful, It's premature. Of course, the Israelis, it goes without saying, are not in favor of that. And those even sympathetic with Palestinians would say, well, understandable, you're frustrated, but it could backfire. Mm-hmm. What are your thoughts as an organization?
Well, I think we're in a period right now where, I mean, it's possibly the lowest trust between two leaders of Palestinians and Israelis. Maybe it was worse between Sharon and Arafat. I think it may very well have been. But let's just say that right now these two leaders do not trust each other. And their trust in the United States, unfortunately, as a broker, is severely diminished. I would be careful about making equivalences here, though. I think we should step back and look what the Palestinians are doing. Yes, they're frustrated. They don't believe that Netanyahu is serious about an agreement. But for years, if we look at, you know, the 60s, 70s, and 80s, the international community made demands on the Palestinians, recognize Israel, and stop violence. And that is what the Palestinian Liberation Organization has done. You know, one can agree or disagree with this tactic of going to international institutions, of joining the International Criminal Court. But at the end of the day, I think people need to recognize that this is a nonviolent legal effort to achieve their rights. So they are, in a sense, doing exactly what has been asked of them. And if people have a better idea of how they should achieve their rights, I'd love to hear it. So, no, it's not optimal. I think the United States could do a much better job of addressing the power asymmetries that exist here. Israel is occupying Palestinian land. I think people understand that. It's important for people to understand the Israeli perspective, too, and their need for security. But I think, in a way, what the Palestinians are doing is both Abbas, as someone who's seen his own political legitimacy diminished and faith in his own leadership severely diminished by these endless rounds of negotiations that don't deliver anything tangible for Palestinians on the ground. He's struggling to find a way to advance the Palestinians' goals and guarding his own political flanks, while at the same time trying to find a way, in a sense, to make clear to the United States that his patience and his ability to wait for the United States to take up this issue again is gone.
What about the so-called unity agreement between Fatah, on the one hand, mm-hmm. the government in the West Bank, and then Hamas?
Right.
Now, most would say, you know, Hamas is the real spoiler here. Hamas, which governs Gaza, which does not recognize Israel as opposed to the Palestinian Authority. So Bibi Netanyahu, the current prime minister, maybe he won't be for long. We don't know. We'll see what happens with Israeli elections in March. That's also an important juncture. But where does this particular agreement stand? Is it working? Because, of course, the two have divergent views vis-a-vis the state of Israel.
No, I would say it's not working. I think there were signs early on that this was a perhaps more serious effort than we'd seen in the past. I think because of a number of things, the Gaza war being a huge factor. You know, when Hamas agreed to these demands back in April, they were under serious pressure. They agreed to these demands almost entirely on Abbas's terms. They agreed to this unity government or this transitional government, a consensus government, I think is more accurate to call it, on terms very, very favorable to Fatah. And there's a number of reasons for that. One, they had lost a number of patrons. The closing of the smuggling tunnels by Egypt had deprived Hamas of revenues, tax revenues, which they would take off the tunnel trade. They had no way to pay their own civil servants, and so they were facing a possible revolt if they didn't come to some agreement that was able to, you know, put money back into Gaza's coffers. Subsequently, we saw the kidnapping of the three Israeli teenagers in the West Bank. We saw a very extensive operation by the Israeli security forces in the West Bank, raiding homes, raiding villages, taking lots of prisoners. They said they were searching for the three boys. We know now that they were almost certainly sure that those boys were dead. But it was an effort to just kind of tamp down Hamas in the West Bank. And in response, you saw, you know, an upsurge of rockets from Gaza into Israel, an Israeli response, and it was just another escalation. And the particularly troubling thing, in addition to all the destruction and death and casualties we saw during the war, was that Hamas came out of that with a bump in popular opinion. You know, they went into the Gaza war on their heels and came out of it. Now, that's not to say that everyone in Gaza loves Hamas. I don't think they do. I think there's polling evidence that shows that. I have anecdotal evidence, just people I talk to. But people in Gaza see themselves in such a hopeless condition under this blockade for all these years that there's a sense in which they admire any attempt to change the status quo, even one that ends up bringing negative consequences on them. But where we are now with regard to the reconciliation agreement, I think it's pretty much nowhere.
Matthew Duss, former senior fellow at the Center for American Progress, who is now president of the Foundation for Middle East Peace. You can hear more of their conversation on our website, voanews.com, under the Programs tab. Look for Press Conference USA.
For more on the stories you've heard on our radio programs, visit our website at voanews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA program. That's VOANews.com. Online news for a changing world.
Police in Thailand's capital announced increased security today for public places, such as bus and train stations, after a pair of blasts outside a popular central Bangkok shopping mall. Two people were slightly injured. VOA correspondent Steve Herman reports from the Thai capital. There are concerns the explosions could usher in a new phase of violence after a relatively calm period since last year's coup.
The Royal Thai Police say they have not yet identified any suspects in the twin bombings outside the Siam Paragon shopping center. The devices, placed behind an electrical transformer, slightly injured one man, panicked pedestrians and commuters, and caused a 30-minute closure of a major mass transit rail station Sunday evening. The explosions also damaged a small public registration center of the Bangkok Metropolitan Authority, which is expected to be closed for repairs for 1 week. The National Police Chief, Somyat Pumpanmuang, says the homemade pipe bombs contained timers for triggering the detonations. The police chief says from the location and material of the bombs, they were not designed to injure or kill anyone. They were intended to threaten and create chaos. Prime Minister Prayut Chan-o-cha has ordered authorities to review closed-circuit television footage and said there had been no prior warning given about the blasts. The junta leader told reporters Monday the incident demonstrates martial law must remain in effect because there are bad people disrupting the peace. The prime minister vowed to find ways to severely punish whomever is responsible. Sources on both sides of Thailand's polarized political spectrum agree the blasts were intended to send a political message. Those who do not favor Thailand's military government are likely to be blamed, although no group has claimed responsibility, and there is no evidence of organized opposition to the coup. On social media Monday, there was speculation that it could have been junta supporters who masterminded the blasts in order to justify a continuation of martial law. The military has been in control of the country since May of last year, when the civilian government was ousted in the latest in a long series of coups over the decades in Thailand. Sunday night's blasts outside the upscale 10-story mall, which has more than 270 shops, was the first such violent incident since the May 22nd coup. Steve Herman, VOA News, Bangkok.
Human beings live on land, if you hadn't noticed, so what lives in the ocean's depths remains mysterious to most. However, the link between our well-being and the oceans is profound. A multi-layered scientific study just published in the journal Science shows how the Earth's oceans could face mass extinctions over the coming decades if steps are not taken soon. VOA's Adam Phillips has the first of two reports on what humans are doing to threaten the ocean's health and what can be done to save it.
To get a clear picture of the state of the world's ocean life, University of California marine ecologist Douglas McCauley and his colleagues collected data from a wide range of sources over several years. For example, to learn how humans have already affected ocean life over the very long term, they analyzed fossil records dating back as much as 50,000 years. They examined global databases on marine animal endangerment and studies on how these animals move, where they spawn and feed, and how they may be interacting with humans.
And we looked at a bunch of different reports and data sources on how humans are changing use in the ocean. So a lot of marine industry indicators and marine industry development reports, all of this to produce this picture of how healthy are marine wildlife, what are we doing to them, and what may be the future for marine wildlife in the next 100 years.
That future could be grim if current trends go unchecked. There's been a dramatic spike recently in ocean farming, also called aquaculture, where huge sections of ocean are cordoned off and fish are bred in ways similar to land-based farms.
In the next 20 years, for example, it's anticipated that globally we'll produce more fish for our plates from aquaculture, from marine farming, than we will from wild harvest, from capturing wild marine species through traditional fishing. You know, we certainly need this new source of food coming in to support communities. However, right now, marine farming is spreading without enough regulation and without enough intelligent forethought. So it's eating up and destroying a lot of very important marine habitats.
McCauley cites the aquatic mangrove forests of Asia as a prime example of a delicate habitat where aquaculture practices are ramping up fast.
Mangroves are a marine habitat, sort of our coastal forests that are nurseries for a lot of fish and marine invertebrates like shrimp and that sort of thing, absolutely essential to these marine wildlife and are being destroyed at really rapid rates because they're also great places for us to start doing this ocean farming.
Destroying mangroves can also be bad for local communities who use traditional methods to hunt the fish that nurse to maturity in those habitats.
What you're looking at is a bit of some trade-offs here. You're able to make money in the short term on farming some of this habitat, but in the long term, you're reducing food security for some of your neighbors.
The sheer scale of aquaculture and other ocean-based enterprises has prompted some to label this a marine industrial revolution that may cause mass extinctions in the oceans, similar to the multiple extinctions of land animals during the industrial revolution of the 18th and 19th century. Then, as now, there was a shift from hunting and trapping animals in the wild to the wholesale destruction of the habitats upon which future generations of those animals depended. Industrial mining of the ocean floor for gold, copper, and other metals for use in products like mobile phones and hybrid cars poses another threat. Corporations have already staked claims to some 1 million square kilometers of seabed. So far, most deep-sea mining operations are small-scale affairs. But soon, expanded operations will deploy 300-ton robots to excavate on scales similar to the largest land-based mines.
They grind up the bottom of the ocean, the ecosystems that live on the seafloor of the ocean, and send it up through these large, gigantic suction tubes to these motherships that support the operation, and then begin to filter out which are the minerals you need and which aren't, and then take that back to the shore for further processing.
McCauley says that a lot of this mining is being planned for huge tracts of ocean that scientists know little about, except that there is life there, and lots of it.
Sometimes there are species that we find nowhere else on the planet, and so as this industry starts and develops, we need to have scientists involved at every stage of the development so that we know exactly what does happen if you scrape up the entire seafloor and how quickly can it recover? Can it recover? What species are lost in this process?
The good news, says ecologist Douglas McCauley, is that we can still pull the oceans back from the so-called extinction cliff they're facing. Such efforts include limiting carbon emissions, effective zoning procedures, and rigorous impact studies. In the second part of our series, we'll look more closely at these and other health remedies for the oceans we all depend on. Adam Phillips, VOA News, New York.
The New England Patriots defeated the Seattle Seahawks 28-24 in the U.S. National Football League's annual Super Bowl championship game in the southwestern state of Arizona, winning its fourth NFL title in 14 years. The Patriots were trailing in the fourth quarter when Patriots quarterback Tom Brady led his team to two scoring drives to take the lead with just 2 minutes to go in regulation. Seattle quarterback Russell Wilson drove the team down deep in New England territory with just seconds remaining, capped by a spectacular 33-yard reception by Jermaine Kearse. Running back Marshawn Lynch ran the ball to the one-yard line, but on the next play, Wilson threw a pass that was intercepted by Patriots rookie defensive back Malcolm Butler to seal the historic win. For the third time in his career, Brady was named the game's most valuable player, finishing the game with 328 passing yards and four touchdowns against the Seahawks' vaulted Legion of Boom defense. He broke the all-time Super Bowl touchdown record with 13, passing the mark set by Brady's childhood idol, Hall of Famer Joe Montana. Here are some excited fans on the game.
Greatest game of all time, greatest quarterback of all time, greatest cornerback of all time, greatest franchise of all time.
It was a tough loss, but it was an exciting game, and we were happy to be here.
I just thought it was a really good game and that we played pretty well, but honestly, I guess the Patriots played a little bit better this time.
Under Brady and head coach Bill Belichick, the Patriots have joined such stellar NFL franchises as the Pittsburgh Steelers, San Francisco 49ers, and Dallas Cowboys with four Super Bowl wins. Seattle's last year's Super Bowl winner was seeking to become the first team to win back-to-back NFL titles since the Patriots accomplished the feat in 2004 and 2005. Thank you for joining us today for International Edition. You can get the latest breaking news and analysis on global events 24 hours a day on our website at voanews.com. And you can listen to this program again if you care to under the Programs tab, International Edition. I'm Susan Yawkey in Washington.